Good afternoon. Welcome to the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee for March 11th, 2026. We do have a quorum. Our quorum is present. Vice Chair Ream, we need to approve the minutes from March 9th, 2026. Would you move, or if you've had an opportunity to review, would you move the minutes, please?
Thank you, Chair Kosnick. Yes, I move to approve the minutes from March 9th, 2026.
Vice Chair Ream has moved the minutes for March 9th, 2026. All those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are approved. Well, welcome to the Transportation Committee. As this time of year, we try to get as many bills up and moving as we can. So a gentle reminder to the public to keep testimony very brief. You will get further instructions on testimony per bill. And also, we request absolute decorum in the meeting. I'm not going to read the whole capital security thing, but we will not tolerate being out of decorum. The first chair on the first bill on the agenda is House File 3676, Chair Nash. Welcome to the committee. And excuse me, before we proceed, members, Representative Keith Allen finally came through about 2 years late, but he provided the cookies to the committee, so enjoy those as we debate these bills. Chair Nash, welcome again. Please introduce your bill. I will make the motion for you to send House File 3637 to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the 45 minutes you promised me I could take in committee. I appreciate
46.
That so much. So House File 3676 before you, and we'll have a couple of amendments, Mr. Chair, that I will ask you to move. So the bill really came to me from my favorite banker in the world, my wife. She was at her place of employment and had a person that was just distraught sitting in front of her talking about a lot of the things that were going on in life as she was doing her banking. And my wife has been given permission to share my contact with whomever needs help. There was a battered woman who moved from California to my district, and I can't say where, and I won't share her name because I'm not going to breach that confidence. But the sum total of what happened was her old Social Security number and her old name were, through a colossal series of screw-ups, I'll watch my language, through a colossal series of screw-ups, were associated with her newly assumed name and her safe-at-home details. And she was very fearful of what would happen with those having been disclosed to her former spouse and abuser. So very quickly, I called the Secretary of State's office and worked with both them and our constituent services to begin addressing this problem. And it really led to the bill that you see before you. So there's fixes for my constituent, but then there are some other fixes that come just in conversations of things that haven't been updated in recent years. And for those that don't know, the Safe at Home program is an unbelievably valuable program for people who have been abused or battered or whatever. So some of the things that are in this bill were things that the Secretary's office brought to my attention. One of them is something that I brought, which is to add an emancipated minor as somebody who can take advantage of this. For those of you that remember, I was an abused kid. I became an emancipated minor at 17. I would not have been able to take advantage of this. So we've added that in there so that an emancipated minor who is out of an abusive relationship can effectively go off the radar. So that is the general part of the bill. Members, we owe it to people who take advantage of this program to make them invisible to their abuser. So I have testifiers with me, Mr. Chair, if you would, or would you prefer to engross the two amendments that we have first?
I would prefer to do the two amendments first. Does it matter which order? We'll do the A4 and the A5.
Your preference, Mr. Chair.
Members, I move the House File 3676 A4 amendment for Representative Nash to get the bill in the order that he prefers. All those in favor of the A4 amendment? Representative Kraft.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, as this is not the first stop of the bill, I would just like to hear what the amendment is. I doubt I have any issue with it, but I'd like to hear what it is before we just approval.
Chair Nash introduced the bill in general. Please describe the A4 amendment briefly.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Kraft. Nicole Freeman from the Office of the Secretary of State. So the A4 removes one section and some lines that related to the use of the Safe at Home address when opening business bank accounts. We've been working with the Minnesota Bankers Association on those components and have found that actually we can address the problem with training from a Minnesota standpoint. And then we also need to chat with the with FinCEN at the federal level to seek some clarification there. So those are the changes, the first two changes in the amendment. And then the third and more substantial change that you can see is adding some reasonable person language to a non-discrimination section in the bill, which is section 6. And so this again is in working with different partners, adding some language around a reasonable person, and it is modeled after other non-discrimination sections and provisions throughout statute.
Thank you. Representative Kraft.
I said thank you.
Oh, okay. Representative Luger and Nikolai, were you asking to be recognized? Okay, all in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The A4 amendment is adopted. Please describe the A5 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A5 is to remove the felony level to a gross misdemeanor. In talking with folks from the Public Safety Committee, they would prefer that it be a gross misdemeanor for a lot of different reasons, mostly around costing, and then also just to make it so that we can actually get this bill to the General Register and get it implemented into law a little bit faster.
Excellent. I will move the A5 amendment for Chair Nash. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the A5 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment is adopted. Any discussion on the overall bill? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, I will renew the motion for House File 3676 as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The bill is adopted as amended, and you are on your way to the General Register. Do you want any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you so much. This is an important bill. It is something that we absolutely owe the people who choose to take advantage of the Safe at Home program. So thanks for your effort in this. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Nash. Next, we have up House File 3593. Representative Jacob. I will move House File 5393. There's a letter in your folder and a fiscal note. Representative Jacobs, welcome to the Transportation Committee. If you could introduce your bill briefly, and then I believe you have some testifiers. So please proceed.
Well, thank you, Chair Kosnick, members of the committee. House File 3593 would simply designate the southernmost 1.4 miles of Highway 58 through the city of Zumbrota as officer/firefighter Gary Schroeder Jr. Memorial, Gary Schroeder Jr. Memorial Highway. I would note that there's a letter of support for the request from the city of Zumbrota, signed by both the mayor of Zumbrota and the city administrator as well. Another note is that we're not requesting any taxpayer funding for the bill, as those would come through donations from the community. And lastly, I did check with Mark Schoenfelder, MnDOT representative for the area, and he had no concerns with the bill. Today I have two testifiers with me, Gary Schroeder Sr. and Gary Schroeder's widow, Kim Schroeder. So we'll start with maybe Gary.
Welcome to the committee, sir. For the audio and video record, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you for being here.
My name is Gary Lee Schroeder, Sr. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Gary Schroeder, Sr., and together with my wife, Susan, we are proud parents of Zumbrota police officer and volunteer firefighter Gary L. Schroeder, Jr., who sadly passed away on April 17, 2023, because of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, developed during his public service. We respectfully request the portion of Highway 58 within the Zumbrota city limits, about 1.4 miles from boundary to boundary, and be named Officer / Firefighter Gary L. Schroeder Jr. Memorial Highway. I understand the responsibility for the sign cost falls to the requesting party, and we are prepared to cover these expenses. I have spoken with the Zumbrota City Administrator Brian Grunham, who fully supports this initiative. Gary Jr. served the city of Zumbrota as a police officer for 18 years. Before that, 3 years with Grand Meadow and Alden Police Departments. He also has volunteered as a firefighter in Zumbrota for 9 years. Due to PTSD, he was medically retired from both roles on December 4th, 2020. Gary Jr. is well-respected and actively engaged in his community. He is survived by his wife of 20 years, Kim, their three sons, Ethan, 20, Kobe, 18, and Jacob, 17. Naming this section of highway in his honor would both recognize his devoted service to the community and raise awareness about PTSD among first responders, and a message of remembrance and advocacy for everyone who travels this highway. I'd just like to make a couple of comments. The day of his funeral, I had a gentleman come up to me and say, "I'm sorry I killed your son." I was kind of taken back at that because I know what happened to my son. Gary had shared this incident with me from August 2018, one of the worst calls Gary Jr. ever responded to, he said. It was a four-year-old son or child died after a wooden swing set had collapsed on top. The child had major head trauma. Gary was the first one on the scene and initiated CPR. Gary said he never wanted to go through that ever again, just knowing that he had three sons of his own at home. The gentleman that came up to me was the child's grandpa. The second, I wanted just to share another story from the day of the funeral. The person that JR had arrested and taken to jail stated JR treated him with the most respect as a person, not as a criminal. In my closing remarks, it's okay not to be okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for considering this request.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony, and I'm sorry for your loss and situation in your family. We'll next move to Ms. Schroeder. Please identify yourself also for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
So my name is Kimberly Schroeder. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. My name is Kim Schroeder. I'm here as Gary Schroeder Jr.'s wife and as the mother of our three boys that we raised together in Zumbrota. Gary proudly served the people of Zumbrota as both a police officer and a volunteer firefighter. Protecting his community wasn't just his profession, it was his purpose. When people were experiencing the worst moments of their life, Gary wanted to be the person who showed up to help them. But to us, Gary was also a husband and a father first. He loved raising our three boys in the same community he served. He believed strongly in teaching them about responsibility, kindness, and service to others. He was proud of his badge, but he was even more proud to be a father. Like many first responders, Gary also carried the weight of things that he saw and experienced over the years. The public often sees the strength of those who respond to emergencies, but they don't always see the invisible toll that trauma can take. Gary ultimately died from a line-of-duty death related to PTSD and suicide. His story is a reminder that the men and women who protect our communities sometimes carry burdens long after the emergency call ends. Naming the stretch of highway in Gary's honor would recognize his dedication and sacrifice, but it would also stand as a reminder that behind every badge is a human being who serves and gives so much of themselves to keep others safe. If Gary's story can help even one more first responder feel seen, supported, and willing to reach out for help, then his legacy will continue to save lives. For our family, and especially our three boys, seeing Gary's name remembered in the community he loved would mean more than words can express. It would ensure that the man who spent his life serving others will not be forgotten. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the committee for your time and for your considering this request to honor Gary Schroeder Jr. and the service he gave to the people of Minnesota.
Thank you for sharing your testimony with us, and again, our condolences for your loss. Members, are there any questions in the committee? I will clarify my motion of House File 3593 to the Ways and Means Committee, and didn't exactly clarify that earlier, but now I will renew my motion, seeing no testimony, committee discussion or questions. I'll renew my motion for House File 3593 be referred to the Committee Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you very much for joining us today and sharing.
Thank you.
Thank you again.
I might want to let them close their bill. Next on the agenda, and my apologies to Representative Jacobs, I didn't allow you closing comments. Are you good? Okay, my apologies. Next on the agenda, we have House File 3785, Representative DePell, and your testifiers. Please make your way. At the conclusion of this bill, we will have House File 3774, and I would encourage the author, you're close by, but also your testifiers to be close to the committee table to save time. Representative DePell, we're going to lay your bill over here. I think we're still waiting on a fiscal note. So I will move for you. Welcome to the committee. I will move for you House File 3785 to be laid over. Please introduce yourself, send to your testifiers, and proceed with your testimony, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick. My name is Representative Tom DePell, and today we're going to be talking about e-motos. E-motos is in a completely different category than an e-bike. Those are classified in Minnesota. There's class 1, 2, and 3 e-bikes, and those bikes are 750 watts or less of power in their motor. Then there's another classification that's between 750 and 1500 watts, and that has its own classification as well. Beyond that, you're talking about a motorcycle. And a motorcycle certainly doesn't belong on the sidewalk. There's already laws against that. But this isn't well defined. There's a lot of areas of the law that have been asking for this. Police officers have been trying to understand, what do we do about these extremely high-powered electric motorcycles? So this bill would clarify exactly what they are and how they should be both regulated and enforced through the law enforcement process. We've got a few different testifiers here, one of which is a constituent of mine, and she'll be coming up in a minute. Her name is Janet, and I'm actually going to pull up a video here. It's body cam footage of her incident. This is going to show exactly what happens when an e-moto is driven on a sidewalk and collides with an individual. But not only that, it's also going to personify, in essence, what law enforcement didn't really know what to do. They didn't really know what to do. They didn't know how to classify this motorcycle. It was originally classified just as an e-bike, and then it was classified as a Class 3 e-bike. But this went beyond all of those things. And so I'm going to go ahead and hit play. Are we up and ready to go?
It looks like we are. Thank you. Please proceed.
Do you need any gas?
No, I don't.
Do you need any gas?
No, it looks like it's not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that gets the point across. Having a visual aid is helpful to understand how serious this issue is and what we're trying to accomplish. Mr. Chair, that is what I had initially, and if you'd like to move to testifiers or the A1, I'd be happy to do so.
Let's disperse with the amendments. There is an A1 amendment. I will move for the author. Please explain the amendments.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. In essence, what this amendment does, it just clarifies to make sure that the bill that we have in front of us is congruent with statute that already exists in law. It doesn't fundamentally change the bill in its meaning. It just makes sure that it agrees with current statute.
Any questions on the amendment? Otherwise, I will move the A1 amendment. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment is adopted. Okay, we have the bill and the amendment adopted. There's two testifiers. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, there may be three and possibly four. I'm okay. Aware of Janet and a representative from Bike MN.
All right, who would you like to go with first?
Mr. Chair, if Janet could go first, she was the individual that was in that video.
Janet, I'm not sure how to say your last name.
Statko.
Staso. Janet, welcome to the committee. Thank you for sharing your story and advocating. Please proceed with your testimony and try to keep it under 2 minutes. Everybody else, we're going to do a minute.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Janet Statko. I'm here today because my life was permanently changed by an accident involving an e-motorbike. I was out on a walk on a sidewalk when I was struck from behind by an e-motorbike traveling at approximately 25 to 30 miles an hour. The rider was an underage minor. At that moment, everything in my life shifted. I suffered a traumatic brain injury, subdural hematoma, carotid artery injury, fractured palate, orbital roof fracture, ruptured eardrum, respiratory trauma, whiplash, and a concussion, just to highlight the extent of my injuries. I was rushed into emergency brain surgery and a craniotomy was performed to save my life. My olfactory nerve was severed, and as a result, I will never taste or smell again. My orbital roof fracture remains open, which will require following by a plastic surgeon with regular CT scans. I also have a permanent frontal lobe damage. I spent 3 weeks in the hospital, including 3 days in the ICU on a ventilator. And as anyone with the traumatic brain injury knows, a TBI is not just an event. It's a lifelong medical journey. I'll always require ongoing care from the neurology team, ENT, plastic surgeon, neuro-ophthalmologists, general practitioners, along with regular CT scans. Every year, I will continue to face deductibles, prescription costs, and the long-term financial impact of these injuries. What has made this even harder is that every insurance avenue was denied. The homeowner's policy was denied the claim. Personal injury protection was denied. Uninsured motorist coverage was denied. Because e-motorbikes are not clearly defined in law, there was no source of compensation for the lifelong journeys I now live with, lifelong injuries I now live with. This has been a devastating experience for me and my family, and I'm not the only person this can happen to. Without clear legal definitions and accountability, victims of these types of accidents are left without protection, without support, and without any path to recovery beyond what they can shoulder on their own. I'm sharing my story because this gap in the law has real human consequences. I survived, and I am grateful to be alive. but survival came with permanent injuries and lifelong costs, not to mention the emotional impact this has carried. Clear legislation is necessary that so no other victim is left without a source of compensation or support after such a life-altering event. Thank you for listening to my story.
Thank you for your testimony. Very powerful. And obviously we see the need for the bill. Thank you, Representative DePell, for bringing it forward. We will have, Michael Wojcik. You're already at the testifier table. Why don't we go with you? We'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota supports this bill. We represent people who bicycle, but we're also a statewide organization that advocates for people who walk and roll as well. Anyone who's hurt using their own physical abilities to move themselves is somebody that we care deeply about. We commend Representative DePell on this bill and the leadership bringing this bipartisan bill forward, because what we've tried to do with this bill is make sure that it's common sense, it's not controversial, it addresses an issue that's out there and works with the existing statutes. We believe this is a good step to raising awareness of the e-moto concept, as well as trying to really get the message out to parents that e-bikes are something that we are very safe and we believe in, but these e-motos have no business being handled in the manner which you just heard about. I will leave it there. We also have one of our volunteers, Matt Moore, from People for Bikes, that can answer potentially any technical questions, but thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Wojcik. Next we have Kyle Markarios, Motorcycle Industry Council. Thank you for your testimony. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. 1 minute, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Kyle Markarios, here on behalf of the Motorcycle Industry Council. We're largely supportive of Representative DePell's bill and have had some good conversations with him and with the advocates, and think we're heading in the right direction. We do have a couple of, I would say, more technical changes that we've requested, and I think that we've worked out with the advocates, so we're hoping that we have some chance to make a couple of, I would say, relatively minor technical changes, particularly in the final two sections of this bill at line 611 and 617 around electrical safety standards. We think it would be appropriate to make sure these vehicles can be certified the way most automotive vehicles are, through certification with SAE standards. So we have that language, and hopefully we'll have the opportunity to get this in the bill as it moves through the process.
Thank you. Have you shared that language with the author?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, we'll try to work through that and try to get you back in committee. We are running a little short on time in session anyways. Is there any other testifiers? Representative Ream, you're a co-author. Do you have any comments? You don't have to if you don't want to, but thank you for co-authoring.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick. Thank you very much, Representative Dipple, for bringing this bill forward, and thank you to Janet Stotko, too, for the testimony. I had read about this in a Star Tribune article last fall, and I think in the article they called the bike an e-bike, and I think it was actually an e-moto. Mm-hmm. And in my area, we have a number of kids who ride these e-motos, and they're being conflated with e-bikes. So I think there is a real need for us to understand the dangers of e-motos and define what an e-bike is versus an e-moto. Parents need to know how dangerous they are. And certainly we don't want this to ever happen again. So thank you so much for your work. It seems like there's a few technicalities that we need to work out, but I'm certainly committed to working with you, Representative DePell, to get this bill passed. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that, Vice Chair. Any other member comments? Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say thank you for sharing your story and how sorry I'm sure we all are for what's happened, but it was very moving. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
you. All righty then. Representative DePell, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just the urgent need to pass this so there is clarification to what the law is, so our peace officers and police officers and really our entire justice system is able to enforce what's appropriate. I appreciate your support. Thank you, Chair Kosnick.
Thank you. I hope you can iron out the little clarifications, and we'll get you back and we can get the fiscal note and move you on your way. So with that, House File 3785 is laid over. excuse me, let me clarify. House File 3785, as amended with the A1 amendment, is laid over. And next, we will proceed with House File 3774, Representative Clarity. As we're settling in, I will move House File 3774. There is one amendment. I will move this to be laid over, I guess. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself. Tell us about the bill, and then we'll proceed with the A1 amendment. So if you want to do both at the same time, that'd be great.
Sure. Great. First of all, thank you, Chair Kosnick. I'm Representative Mary Frances Clardy. And what else did you ask for?
Tell us about your bill.
Okay,
and
great.
Where it came from.
So the origin of the bill is Mark came to me and he was really concerned about bicycle automobile safety. He had seen some close calls, and it also kind of took me back to when my niece and nephew were in that little cart that's behind a bicycle and they were struck by a car. So that's the essence of why I brought it forward. Okay. So the original bill was to have bicycles stop at the yellow lights. Okay. Period. After some consultation, can I move on to the A1? Okay, thank you. So after consulting with some people and Bike MN, I found out that one size fit all did not fit everything. So we've done some modifications. So in the amendment, you will see that Mary Frances doesn't have her glasses, but basically now it is only for like bicycles to have to stop on protected zones. So like if it's a dedicated zone, like you might see one beside the side of a freeway that's bicycle specific, and that might have bicycle lights, that type of thing. But I'm going to actually just stop there and ask for one of my witnesses to talk.
Thank you. What we'll do is I'll move the A1 amendment so that it is technically in front of the committee. Representative Kosnick, Chair Kosnick moves the A1 amendment for House File 3774. Thank you for the little explanation. Members, do you have any questions on the A1 amendment? No? Okay, then we will, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. And then let's proceed with your testifiers, please, Representative Clarity.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick.
We'll start with Mr. Hartman.
Yes.
Hi.
Welcome to the committee. Again, introduce yourself and then proceed, please.
Hi, I'm Mark Hartman. I brought the bill forward to Mary Frances. Primarily what I see when I bike through downtown Minneapolis is that I'll usually ride in the bike lane, and similarly I'll have either some group of people behind me or beside me. And typically when it comes to an intersection, I see most people try to race against the yellow light. But the primary issue that I see with this is that the traffic parallel going the same direction often provides a obfuscation of any bikers in the bike lane. So I believe it's just a relative common sense thing to recognize that there is an obfuscation, and that when that car clears, any car idling inside the middle of the box to turn left won't immediately spot the biker and keep going forward. And I've seen several close calls, so I'm just looking to get that corrected, hopefully.
Well, thank you very much. So, Mr. Wojcik, why don't you proceed with testimony, and there might be a question or two. Thanks.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Again, Michael Wojcik, Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota. We support the A1 amendment. Keeping this incredibly concise, there are certain circumstances where an immediate stop at a yellow light would not be something that we would recommend. In particular, when you're in shared traffic with automobiles, bicycles can stop much faster than cars, and if you're unaware of a car behind you, an immediate unexpected stop at a yellow light is an incredibly dangerous situation. And just as we did with the Idaho stop years ago, ago. One of our goals is to clear bicyclists from intersections as quickly as possible, as that is a point of danger for people who bike, walk, and roll, and we generally want to keep people out of this area. The A1 amendment uses some language to basically apply this where it is most safe to do so, and we support that. And we also would commend Representative Clardy on learning about the issue, taking the time to meet with us, bringing parties together, and coming up with something that we all support.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions? Representative Scraba?
I guess you cleared it up because you – sorry, Chair.
Go ahead.
You cleared it up about where you stop. The next one is controlled by a bicycle-specific traffic control signal. What is that?
Mr. Wojcik, or the author?
Thank you for that question. I can assure you, being from the Iron Range myself, there aren't very many of them up there, but you can pronounce my name very well, so there. Specifically, when you start talking about the kind of infrastructure that we mention in here, a lot of times will actually be a separate set of signals that are specifically for bicyclists, and it's that area where you might have a lot of times those will simply be green and red, and that's the area where if you get a yellow light, no, that means stop at that point.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, Jackson Street on St. Paul has those lights. Okay, thank you. Now I know what they're for. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ream, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick, and thank you, Representative Clardy, for bringing forth this bill. I do have some questions and would love some clarification on the Idaho stop versus this bill, and I'm thinking maybe Mr. Wojcik could help us explain that because it is rather confusing. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair. That was going to be kind of the question, just to clarify. I don't want to dwell on it too long, but a couple years ago, it was passed, an Idaho stop, meaning you don't have to stop. Representative Clarity's bill says that we should stop. We did an amendment. What is a biker supposed to do?
Thank you for that very open-ended question. I will condense my answer down from the previous 2 hours. These are really talking about two different things. The Idaho stop has two parts, one of which has been adopted in Minnesota, one of which we hope to adopt in Minnesota in the future. The current Idaho stop specifically deals with stop signs, and what happens when there's a stop sign and nobody coming, cyclists can use them as yield. Now, if there's somebody coming the other direction, they have to give the right-of-way, you still have to stop. That's the Idaho stop. The second part of the Idaho stop is specifically if you come to a signal that is red, but there is no traffic in either direction, you then have to come to a complete stop still, but you may proceed. That is not law yet in Minnesota. We do hope to see that at some point. This is particularly dealing with a different circumstance where you're coming up to a signal that is, you know, going from green to yellow to red, and you're on a separate bikeway that has its own bike signals that if it's yellow there, Now you have to stop, and that would be the best practice for cyclists as well.
So if they're in a separate bike lane, they do have to stop, but if they're in the road right away and the shoulder, they don't?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you are sharing space with automobiles, and it's one of those areas where you could potentially have an automobile behind you. In general, those are the places that this does not apply because you're in that mixed traffic and you don't want to do something unexpected.
Thank you for that explanation. Any other member questions? Very good. Representative Clarity, would you like to have closing comments on your bill, please?
Yeah, first of all, I just wanted to thank the bicycle community, Mark's Bicyclists and Bicycle Minnesota. I also think that this is really an important bill because as we move forward with an environmentally friendly community, we need to encourage as much bicycling as we can. So my intention was focusing on safety. Thank you.
Thank you. Hold on for a second. Okay, I will renew my motion for House File 3774 as amended to be laid over. I guess that is the motion. Your bill is laid over. Next, we will do the House File 4111. I will pass the gavel to Representative Olson.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair.
But hold on a second. I'm just going to testify from here. We'll have the testifiers up there. In order to get through all the testifiers, we will cut off testimony about 2:25. You get about 60 seconds. Please, we've read the letters in the packet. We've met with many of the people testifying, and so we're familiar with concerns, and then we will proceed with the vote. I will get my folder ready.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like to start by introducing your bill and making a motion to, I believe it's going to Ways and Means, is that correct? All right, would you like to make that motion and then introduce your bill? Too fast. No time.
Thank you very much, members. I will move House File 4111 to the Committee on Ways and Means. And we introduced this bill. We'll share an explanation that I have emailed some of the members to share an explanation of the bill that restructures our bus service in the metropolitan area. This is a data-driven initiative to transition the metropolitan area transit from four suburban providers, Maple Grove Transit, Minnesota Valley Authority, Plymouth Metrolink and Southwest Transit, and Metro Transit into a single regional system operated by Metro Transit. This proposal makes sense for efficiency and fiscal and rider service reasons. The estimate is that we can save about $50 million every budget cycle through the current transit funds. Good routes that are used in these suburban areas will continue to be preserved. That is in the bill. What we are eliminating, however, and we cannot keep running routes that few people use and that are three times more expensive than similar routes. The 29 high subsidy routes average $85 a ride subsidy, according to the report that we heard at the beginning of this session. The subsidies ranged as high as $270 a ride to a little over $50 a ride. The high subsidy routes should be and will be terminated, but the more efficient routes could be planned in later years. Nobody should be defending the horrible high subsidy routes and mismanagement. The current fragmented 50-year-old opt-out model no longer reflects how transit is funded or used and creates significant service and fiscal inefficiencies, and it limits our ability to deliver cost-effective service across the entire metro region. The original rationale for the extra opt-out suburban providers no longer exist. Suburban agencies were created in the 80s because suburban communities were paying local property taxes into the regional bus system and wanted a voice in how those local taxes were being invested in service. That changed in 2001 when the legislature eliminated transit operating property tax and replaced it with state general funds and support from the motor vehicle sales tax revenue. Since 2002, all providers, Metro Transit and the opt-outs, have drawn from the same state funding pool. Yet we continue to maintain five separate administrative structures, despite having four providers that deliver only 4% of the rides, and Metro Transit currently provides almost 96% of the rides. The cost to provide the same services are very stark. According to the 2024 Regional Route Performance Analysis, MBTA's suburban local service costs $40.20 per passenger compared to Metro Transit's $15.35. Further, Southwest Transit's micro transit service costs $54.91 per passenger subsidy. That's more than 60% above average, peer averages, and more expensive than regionally mandated Metro Mobility service as well. This service amounts to nearly 77% of Southwest Transit's local service. Minnesota Valley Transit microservice costs $36.23 per passenger. Plymouth, they cost $29.91, and Metro Transit has a cost of $21 only. We heard the findings of the high subsidy report at the beginning of committee session in committee and found that Minnesota Valley Transit operates two-thirds of all high subsidy routes in the region, despite their low percentage of rides. Shockingly, these routes represent 30% of their entire operating budget. Additionally, we found that their decision to operate this highly efficient service drives additional cost to the state through mandated Metro Mobility service required on these vastly underperforming routes. There are not marginal differences. These are structural and persistent, as the attached high subsidy report shows that we reviewed earlier this year. When you combine the administrative overhead for the four opt-out providers, their collective administrative overhead is 52% of their budgets. Maintaining four separate administrative bodies for providers that provide together only 4.5% of the regional rides is not fiscally responsible, even if they were efficient routes. In this case, the report and the numbers tell us that it's anything but efficient. I believe a single regional route bus service would improve efficiency, provide significant savings, again, about $50 million a biennium. Consolidation could save millions annually in unnecessary administrative redundancy alone. In other words, if we had four separate systems or five separate systems and they were all running efficient, and we merged them, we would still save millions of dollars. This will allow us to have the same service be delivered throughout these communities at significantly less cost. It will eliminate service redundancies and improve network coordination by eliminating duplicative routes as well. This bill has a mechanism for local suburban communities to have input. We're not taking that away. This approach will ensure resources are allocated based on need and new post-COVID transit patterns rather than through inefficient parochial fights and mindsets. So with that, what I would like to do is have Mr. Burris walk us through the bill. If that'd be all right.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we can have Mr. Burris go through the bill, please.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 1 of the bill, and this is House File 4111, Section 1 establishes a new statute that would lay out that the Metropolitan Council is the exclusive transit operator, as well as limit local units of government from expenditures for transit, with exceptions for operations under an agreement. This section also sets out a implementation timeline so that the new exclusive transit operation by the council would begin July 1st, 2027. It also establishes an exception for the University of Minnesota. Section 2 contains a conforming change to some of the other provisions in the bill. Section 3 establishes an expiration for the current financial assistance that's provided to the suburban transit providers. And then Section 4 sets out some requirements and planning components to establishing the consolidated transit. This includes some general requirements on the implementation process, direction to the Metropolitan Council to establish an implementation plan, as well as some provisions within the section setting out a task force that would advise the council on implementation, both the plan components and plan development, as well as implementation practices. And then section 5, which is found on page 6 of the bill, directs the Metropolitan Council to perform a study of transit service in the area that's currently served by the suburban transit providers. And that's the brief walkthrough of the bill provisions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. Mr. Chair, is there, do we want to go with the amendment, or would you like to continue with your introduction?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I think we should discuss and adopt the A1 amendment. Representative Joy, were you going to adopt, introduce that or offer that?
Representative Joy has the A1 amendment. Would you like to move the amendment and then introduce it, please?
Yes, I'll move A1, and what that does is it gives us a report, so when we do this that we're making sure we're getting a report back and we're being good stewards and getting reports of the cost effectiveness.
Are there any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say no. The ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Olson. What I think would be appropriate also is if Mr. Lee might walk us through the fiscal note. The savings are within the transit funds, not general funds. And so I believe that's found on page 6. But if
Mr. Lee, if you would go through the fiscal note, please.
Mr. Chair and members, the fiscal note in your packet for House File 4111 has 13 pages and includes the Secretary of State, the Metropolitan Council, and the Department of Transportation that composed this fiscal note. Jumping to page 3 shows the Metropolitan Council's portion of the fiscal note. You'll notice the general fund savings starting in fiscal year 2028 and continuing in fiscal year 2029. That relates specifically to the general fund forecast appropriation for Metro Mobility. And that those assumptions are spelled out later in the fiscal note. So on page 4, this begins the Met Council's narrative on the bill. And jumping then to the top of page 5, the first few paragraphs are explanations of changes to high subsidy transit routes and the council's analysis on those, with the explanation of the savings beginning about halfway down the page. And then the last three paragraphs of page 5 are explanation of changes for Metro Mobility. Then starting on the bottom of page 5 and continuing on to page 6 is an explanation of the various general fund and savings from transit funds, specifically the motor vehicle sales tax and the regional sales tax.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Over to Chair Kosnick.
Thank you. So, members, and they're mostly on page 6 is where the big savings come in for the annual operating savings and their additional $24.7 in one-time savings. I believe we have with us Mr. Charles Carlson from Metro Transportation Services. Is that the right? Available for questions. And then other than that, I guess we can proceed with testimony.
All right. That sounds good, Mr. Chair. So I currently have 17 individuals signed up to testify, and the chair wants the testimony to be closed off at 2:20, which gives us about 25 minutes to get that completed. I'm so sorry, but I think that I'm going to have to start a timer and have it go at 1:30. So at 1 minute and 30 seconds, we're going to have the timer go off, and then I need you to really cut your comments short. I so apologize for this. This is just kind of the way we're going to run with it. So first on deck,
I've got Annette Meeks first, then I've got Eric Hansen after, and then Tom Workman. If you all can kind of position yourself in a position so that you can quickly respond and provide time for everyone. Annette Meeks? Meeks is not here. Looks like you all got 10 more seconds.
And all
right.
There are chairs behind the testifier table, so please proceed to fill those spots in so we can be efficient. Mr. Baker will hold up a stop sign when you've exhausted your time.
We've got Eric Hansen first, Tom Workman, then Michaela Hatfield. Mr. Hansen, please state your name for the record and begin with your testimony.
Good afternoon, committee members. I'm Eric Hansen, the CEO of Southwest Transit. There are many reasons why you should oppose this bill today, and I will focus on one. This legislation will not save money. I've seen the fiscal note. You just heard about it. It makes a whole lot of assumptions that certain services will be cut, like high subsidy routes, microtransit, or metro mobility service. There is nothing in this bill that requires any of these service changes. And if I were in your shoes, I would have real heartburn about voting for something with this many specious assumptions. Here's why there are no savings. By law, 34.3% of all motor vehicle sales tax in the state and 83% of the regional sales tax collected is remitted to Met Council. They then pass a portion of that to the opt-out suburban transit agencies. If this bill is passed, those percentages will not change. Taxes that today are sent to suburban agencies will simply be retained by Met Council. Put another way, the size of the pie will be the same. This legislation simply means that Met Council's piece would now be the entire pie. Make no mistake, this bill is really just a tax redistribution scheme disguised as a cost-saving measure. For 40 years, Southwest Transit has delivered efficient, community-focused service as part of the region's transit system. Eliminating us will not solve the concerns about a small number of high-subsidy routes, none of which are at Southwest Transit, and it risks reducing service for the thousands of riders who depend on it. We ask you to vote against this bill today and instead work with us to improve efficiency rather than eliminating services that are so critical to our community.
Wow, that was 1 minute and 30 seconds. It was perfect. If we can keep that, we'll be in great shape. All right, so next up we have Tom Workman, then Michaela Hatfield, then Carol. That's right. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I am Tom Workman. I currently serve as the chairman of the Carver County Board of Commissioners. When I served in the state legislature, I also chaired the House Transportation Committee, and I've been involved in transportation issues for 40 years. I'm here today to express my steadfast support for Southwest Transit and our transit system that has stood the test of time for 40 years. Southwest Transit has been an incredible partner to Carver County, and as our community grows, I know we need even more transit and not less. And less transit is what we are going to get if this bill passes. I know this because there is no way you can save money on transit without cutting service. And this is exactly what our representatives knew 40 years ago when they allowed communities to opt out of the metropolitan transit system. They knew that to get good transit service, they had to do it themselves. Now here we go again 40 years later, and we're about to make the same mistake. This is a mistake we can't afford to make. This will reduce transit service and harm our communities. Thank you, and I urge you to vote against this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Perfect. We're doing great with our time, everyone. Thank you so much. Michaela Hatfield, then Carol.
Safety.
And Taylor Hubbard will be third. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
All right, thank you. My name is Michaela Hatfield, and I serve on the Chaska City Council. I'm also chair of the Southwest Transit Commission. I'm here to strongly oppose this proposal. Moving Southwest Transit into the Met Council would reduce local oversight. It would weaken accountability and eliminate the nimble, community-responsive service model that has helped strengthen the region's transit network. At Southwest Transit, we actively monitor subsidized routes and adjust when needed. As noted in the high subsidy report, we had one level three route in 2023. It moved to two in 2024 and is expected to be at a level one in 2025. That progress happened because local oversight allows us to respond quickly and improve performance in real time. We also benchmark ourselves through the National Transit Database against peer systems across the country, monitoring costs. That oversight is already happening at Southwest Transit. These results are why Southwest Transit has been one of the fastest growing transit agencies in the country in the post-COVID recovery. Our, out of more than 1,000 systems tracked by the FTA across bus, rail, and ferry service, Southwest Transit has emerged as a national success story. We are the 14th fastest growing agency in the country, and that did not happen by accident. It happened because local providers can move quickly, adapt service, and meet the needs of the communities we serve. This proposal is a step backwards. Southwest Transit is not a problem that needs to be fixed, and consolidation is not cost savings. What this would do is absorb a high-performing local provider into a much larger system with less local control, less flexibility, and less accountability, resulting in a loss of service, innovation, and most importantly, a loss for the communities we serve. I respectfully ask you to vote no. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. We've got Carol, then Taylor, then Jerry McDonald will be third. Carol, would you please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony?
Hi, my name is Carol Safke, and due to a disability, I do not drive. So Southwest Transit saved me. I use Southwest Transit daily for the gym, also for medical appointments, and many others. Southwest Transit is a necessity for me to live a normal life. Southwest Transit must continue. Thank you.
Wow, thank you so very much, Carol. Next, we have Taylor Hubbard is next, and we have Jerry McDonald and Christy Janigo. If you can move your way up, and Taylor, please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Sure. My name is Taylor Hubbard. Thank you, Chair and community members, for the opportunity. I have the honor of serving as the mayor of Chaska. I'm here today to respectfully express our community's opposition to this bill. In Chaska, transit is not a luxury. It is a lifeline. It is essential infrastructure that supports our workforce, our economy, and our community's quality of life. I regularly hear from residents who rely on Southwest Transit every day for services like express commuter buses to Minneapolis and Southwest Prime, their microtransit option. It is the only way they can get to their job, school, and vital medical appointments. It allows them to remain independent and connected to their community. I think about the older adult who needs to get to their doctor's appointment, the individual with a disability who wants to attend their services at church, or a resident who needs to get to a local food shelf to have meals for the week. In Chaska, transit, in order for it to be successful, it needs to get to the front door. Southwest Transit is our trusted partner who helps bridge the gap by delivering flexible and efficient service that meets people where they are. For these reasons, the City of Chaska urges the committee to vote no so that we can continue to support the current transit systems that allow our community to thrive. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you so much. Wow, and thank you everyone for your attention to the timeline. I'm really appreciating this. We've got Jerry McDonald next, then Christy Janigo, and then Chris Labowney will be third. Would you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, my name is Jerry McDonald. I am currently a member of the Chanhassen City Council, and I'm also on the Commission for Southwest Transit. I have over 20 years of service to the city of Chanhassen, roughly 15 years of service to Southwest Transit. I have to tell you that looking at public transit, it's not about dollars, it's about service. The reason we're where we are today is because of a lack of service. If you go forward with this bill, you will send us back to where we were before the opt-outs ever were organized. It has always been about service. One of the things that Southwest Transit has done over the years is we have innovated service within our communities. We have gone where people need us to go. I have worked with our senior commissions. I have worked with people that are in need of transportation to get to jobs. I have worked with our community businesses to get workers from a transit station to their employment. We are the ones who make the connections so that people can get where they need to go. That is not always about money. Yes, we are very concerned about the bottom line, and as Michaela had said, we look at that and we stringently will cut service that does not meet a requirement. We are more than willing to work with setting up those requirements to look at what you would need to do. But at the end of the day, what you should be looking at is how do you fund a transit service so that we can serve our communities better. Metro Transit will not be able to take up the slack. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. On deck, we've got Josh Kimber. Ms. Janigo, would you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Dr. Christy Janigo, Maple Grove City Council member, speaking on behalf of Maple Grove Transit, and I'm joined by Public Works Director Chris Labonte in case there are any questions. Since its inception in 1990, Maple Grove Transit has been a leader in transit efficiency and effectiveness. Not only have we provided over 17 million rides in the last 36 years, but we continue to have some of the lowest subsidized commuter routes in the region, the busiest park and ride station in the metro, and excellent rider reviews on our customer service. Beyond the success of commuter service, our micro transit service, MyRide, continues to thrive due to local oversight. This service provides a substantial amount of workforce transportation, supporting the economic competitiveness of the region and connects those who are transit dependent to critical services. Our buses bring seniors to medical appointments, youth to activities, workers to jobs, families to the grocery store, and people in need to services like food shelves. We strongly oppose HF 4111 as it not only threatens this model of effective and efficient transit service, but it casts great doubt as to what transit would look like in our community or whether transit service would exist here at all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Ms. Janigo. Next on deck, we've got Eric Pershman. Chris Labonte, you were just there in support role. Excellent. So we've got Josh Kimber next. Eric Pershman is after. And then Lexi Cornolo. I'm so sorry. With a name like Bjorn Olsen, I should be better at pronouncing people's names. Josh, if you would please state your name for the record and begin with your testimony.
Yep, thank you, Chair Olson. My name is Josh Kimber. I'm here representing here as Vice Chair of Southwest Transit, Vice Chair of the Suburban Transit Association, and also a member of the Chanhassen City Council. As Vice Chair of the Suburban Transit Association, I respectfully request you oppose this legislation. The SDA represents four agencies targeted by this legislation, serving 12 communities across the metro. Last year, we delivered 2.1 million rides. These agencies were created in 1982 because communities were paying for a transit service, yet we were not receiving service. There are three main benefits to the Suburban Transit Association. I'd like to cover those three with you quickly. First, we provide service shaped by local communities. Because our agencies are locally governed, decisions are made by people who understand the needs of the growing communities we serve. That means service can be more responsive, more targeted, and more effective. Under this proposal, these decisions would shift to the Metropolitan Council, placing them further away from our residents and the communities most affected. Second, we strengthen the regional transit system by connecting communities that might otherwise be left out. Our providers help link the outer ring suburbs and the rural areas to the broader transit network. Third, our suburban transit providers have been the leaders in innovation. Because our agencies are smaller and more flexible, we've been able to test, pilot, and refine new ideas that benefit the entire transit system. Our agencies have pioneered microtransit in the Twin Cities, launched Wi-Fi connected buses, added automatic passenger counters, deployed electric microtransit vehicles, and more. Again, this bill cannot be changed through amendments. From our perspective, we respectfully ask for you to decline.
Thank you so much. Is Eric Pershman here?
Right here.
There he is. Perfect. Eric Pershman, then Lexi, then Scott Aldrich will be third. Eric, if you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Eric Pershman. I'm a city council member for Carver, and by way of that, I'm also a board member for Southwest Transit. I'm going to dispense a little bit with my presentation. I might even give you some seconds back. Carver is growing rapidly. The Southwest metro area is growing rapidly, 500% since I moved there in 2000. We're going to double in size to about 14,000 in the next 10 years. This kind of growth is happening all over the Southwest, but Carver is not a part of the Met Transit's district. We're not even a part of the joint powers agreement that governs Southwest Transit. We are served by Southwest Transit because of its ability to dynamically work with the community that it's in. It's not just Carver, Victoria, Waconia. We're the up-and-coming communities that are depending on this kind of service. Mention was made of microtransit. We had 3,000 microtransit rides last year just in the city of Carver. It's an important service. We don't want to see that go away, and without that partnership with a regional company like Southwest Transit, a city like mine loses our ability to service all of our residents. So with that, I also respectfully request you to decline.
Thank you so much. We've got Lexi next, Scott Aldrich, and then Nass Nicardi. Lexi, would you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, let me pull this up. Alexa Cornolo. No worries, I'm mispronouncing. It's Italian. Do I start whenever?
Okay. Absolutely. Please begin your testimony.
Okay. I'm currently a third-year political science student at the University of Minnesota, and I'm here today because I was a previous marketing intern for Southwest Transit. During the course of my internship, I had the opportunity to table at over a dozen community events throughout my internship, and through representing the transportation agency, I was able to connect with community members directly and speak to them face-to-face about how much Southwest Transit meant to them. It's clear today with all the people that have spoken to you and the many people that you see wearing this shirt that Southwest Transit is incredibly important to its community individually, and I feel very strongly about you guys opposing the bill. But as a university student and a hometown member of the area Southwest Transit serves, I've yet to hear a single negative thing about the buses, drivers, routes, or anything else related. The partnerships and community efforts that Southwest Transit has committed itself to is undeniable, and as I'm sure you can tell from the many people here today, it's very important to us. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I strongly urge you to oppose this bill.
Thank you so very much. We've got Scott next, then Naz, and then Clint Hoopa will be third. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Scott Aldrich. I'm council member in the city of Plymouth. I'm here representing Plymouth Metrolink. I'm here to urge the committee to preserve local control and maintain Minnesota's suburban transit providers. The city of Plymouth welcomes accountability and is committed to responsible stewardship of taxpayer dollars. The recent legislative subsidy report exemplifies that effective oversight strengthens our transit systems. The benefit, though, local control produces better service. Cities like Plymouth can quickly adjust routes, schedules, and service levels based on feedback from the people that use the service. And that is something that a centralized system simply cannot replicate. We all share the same goal here, improving transit for the people who rely on it. We support the legislature's review of efficiencies. Plymouth supports running efficiently, and we would like to work with the author throughout the process. And Minnesota's transit system works best when it allows for regional coordination while preserving local expertise and accountability. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so very much. Next up, we have Naz, then Clint, and then Elizabeth Ranum. If you'd please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi there. I'm Naz Norkadi. I'm with Move Minnesota Action, where we advocate for a sustainable transportation system in the state of Minnesota. Chair Kosnick and to the rest of the committee, thanks again for having me here to speak about the legislation. Operating under the assumption that service is maintained for our riders in the affected cities, we believe consolidation would be the right choice to make. Public transit has historically been disinvested in for decades, and last year we saw significant cuts to general funds for transit. Consolidation should support stronger regional coordination with the intent for the sales tax to expand our public transit system. That being said, I do have a couple concerns and considerations that I would like to bring forward. First, the timing feels hasty. I suppose it is possible for the task force to present a preliminary draft consolidation plan by February 1st, but I'm concerned that from February 1st to July 1st, 5 months, implementation must have occurred, despite the framework being presented as a preliminary draft, meaning that any, quote, consequential implementation considerations that the bill recognizes might realistically occur may have to be resolved in real time alongside implementation. I'd recommend that you should postpone setting an implementation date until after the draft plan is seen and thoroughly discussed in everybody's best interest. Two, there are no transportation advocacy organizations, transit riders, or community organizations of any kind designated as appointees to the task force. I think organizations and individuals who are entrenched in everyday interactions with transportation and other related topics should have their perspectives considered. I would implore you to think about these considerations, but we are in support of consolidation with maintained service. Furthermore, consolidation itself won't solve our problems. In the future, we need to consider land use policy and patterns. Thank you so much, Anna. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so very much. Next, we have Clint, then Elizabeth, and then Emma Dufresne, I believe, and that's the last on my list. So if someone's going to want to speak after that, we still are doing well on time. Would you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Clint Hoopa, mayor of Apple Valley,
And I'm also Apple Valley's representative on the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority's board. While I served on that board, I speak to you today as the mayor of a community that benefits from the suburban transit model. Communities served by these suburban providers like Minnesota Valley are among some of our fastest growing areas in the region. That's not just in population, but that's in job growth as well. Those residents depend on transit that reflects a fundamentally different need: longer commutes, suburb to suburb connections, reverse commutes to get people out to those job centers, and local mobility, especially for our senior population. What makes suburban providers effective is that local governance, made up of elected officials in the communities that are served. That connection, the board of MVTA, is directly connected to city councils, employers, riders, and communities, and understand how transit actually operates. Just a few quick examples of where we see that play out in real life, because we serve real people. I'm talking about students that need to get to DCTC from across our South Metro area. I'm talking about a senior microtransit riders that need door-to-door service to get from their home to groceries and medical appointments. I'm also talking about serving places like the Minnesota Zoo, which we're now able to do 7 days a week, which helps them expand their Free to Explore program. But for me as mayor, what really matters is that when there's a service issue, a facility concern, and the like, we have a local seat at the table and a local one call to our MVTA operating team. For all those reasons, I respectfully ask that the legislature preserve our suburban transit model that's working for our communities. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you so very much. We have Elizabeth next, and then Emma, and then that's all I've got on the list. So, Elizabeth, if you would please, when ready, state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Okay. My name is Elizabeth Ranum. I live in the South Metro and have relied on MVTA Connect Microtransit for the past 5 years as my primary transportation. I work 5 days a week as a pharmacy cashier at Walmart, and MVTA Connect is how I get to and from work. I also use the service for medical appointments, errands, and just simply getting out of the apartment when I feel isolated. I do not have a personal vehicle, and like many riders, I depend on public transportation to stay connected to my job and my community. For me and many others in the South Metro, MVTA Connect is not just transportation, it is a lifeline. Eliminating MVTA would put services like Connect and local suburban bus routes at risk and could take away critical resource that people like me rely on every day. I understand that if this bill proceeds, it would only ensure that I would have similar services for a year, and then Met Council, who I don't know anything about, would determine what service I would get. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you so very much. And the last one I have on the list is Emma. If you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, and thank you for listening to me, committee members. My name is Emma Dufresne. I'm a graduate student at the University of Minnesota, and I live in Minnetonka, so I rely on Southwest Transit to get me to school and work at least 4 days a week all year long. And as part of my daily routine, I depend on Southwest to safely and comfortably get me to work and school. I greatly appreciate that Southwest sees the need in the community to service this route. And I see Southwest as a key component of my neighborhood, and I fear that this bill would take that away. And so please oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. That is the end of my list. You've all done so very well. Thank you. Please absolutely come up, and once you get there, state your name for the record and begin your testimony. We've got just a couple more minutes before we need to move on. State your name for the record when ready and begin your testimony.
Hello, I'm Marie Snodgrass. I am from Chaska, a Southwest suburb, and I'm here today speaking against the consolidation of Southwest Transit under the Metropolitan Council. We need to keep control local. It works. It works great. I personally have used Southwest Transit. I used to use it to commute to Minneapolis for my job. I use the airport shuttle regularly, the state fair, sports. They have it for the Arboretum Lights. They have it for other local activities. They do it to the Renaissance Festival. It saves a lot of people from needing a car. Students use it regularly to commute to the colleges and to jobs. Seniors, low-income workers, and workers use it to get their groceries, to go to doctor's visits, and other things. Southwest Transit is a community gem. The needs of the Southwest suburbs are different than the needs of the Minneapolis Metro. Please vote no for this consolidation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Did you want to testify as well? We have time for just the last one. One more. Thank you so much. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you for hearing my comments today. My name is Cindy Lee. I am from Jordan, Minnesota, and I recently retired after working 30 years for investment firms in downtown Minneapolis. For all of those years, I used Southwest Transit for commuting from the Chaska-Chanhassen area, and throughout the years, the routes and the buses changed. When I started, I would catch the bus from the Jonathan General Store, or if I wanted to, I could go walk to the corner in Hunter Mark, and the bus would pick me up there. There was a point where our commute made bus transfers at the Eden Prairie Mall and Shady Oak Park and Ride. We rode the buses in the morning, 6:30, watch the sunrise, and we rode the buses during rain and snowstorms, not being able to see outside the windows due to heavy condensation. Some of those rides were an hour and a half to 2 hours long standing up because the buses were filled. But our drivers always got us where we needed to be, and we would thank our drivers as we exited the bus for our safe travel. I didn't always know the name of the bus driver, but I recognized them and knew them, and they knew us. They were always professional and kind. And this is the culture that Southwest Transit, the leadership and staff, have created and which flows into the whole shared rider experience. Our rides were safe, comfortable, and riders watched out for each other. I called my fellow riders my bus buddies. They let me know if I got on the wrong bus. They tap someone on the shoulder and say, this is your stop. This is where you get off. They'd bring a rider back to Eden Prairie if that rider accidentally got on the Chanhassen bus. So this kind of service and this rider experience is community. And I would not want to see that level of service change with any kind of merger.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. All right, Mr. Chair, seeing no final testifiers, how would you like to proceed?
I'll proceed with member discussion.
Are there any discussion to this bill? Mr. Chair, do you want to go first or do you want to go last? Mr. Chair, it's to you.
I'll possibly go first and last.
Oh, I love
that.
See
what happens with that. I want to apologize for everybody. I had a bill in Ag Committee that looks favorable, so that's good. So we'll see what happens with there. So I apologize that I missed the beginning of the conversation today, but I just wanted to talk just a moment and then ask Met Council to come up and answer a couple questions for me as to how this could move forward. So I have been thinking about this issue for a very long time as to what, how we can best provide service to the transit riders all across the metro. And so I'm very glad we're having this discussion today and very glad that we are talking about moving forward, and especially glad at everybody in this room who cares deeply about transit. Like, that is a beautiful, beautiful thing, and how important it is for us all to have solid, efficient, well-run connections to get us from our home to our work and get us from home to the grocery store and wherever that may be, and finding pathways in order to do that. So everything that I've thought about and worked on in this bill is focused on both the entire metro and how we can deliver the best possible service for every single person in the metro that's included on in the work we do here, but also for my district and how we can make sure that we are serving people of Shakopee best and making sure that we are able to roll forward that way. So I've got a couple questions for Met Council, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Proceed with questions.
Thank you. So thank you very much for being here. We have, in 2023, we passed legislation that was able to build out our operating facilities and build out our ways to fund transit across the entire metro with the metro-wide sales tax. And that is funding operations. It's funding a little bit of build out. It is funding safety in our transit system. It's funding a lot of different things. But it is also not getting us exactly where we need to go and making sure that we have a transit system that is focused on the future and where we want things to go. One question that I get a lot of times from folks is how, just like basics of how we use the transit system, because my community is covered by MVTA, and I'd say that 75% of the folks don't understand that they can get on an MVTA bus and get to downtown Minneapolis because it's a Metro Transit, and how they make that transition with different apps and different things like that. It is, we want to focus on the transit rider. And so with that being said, my question for Met Council is on the fiscal note that has been produced that everyone has hopefully seen today. And I know, again, I missed the discussion at the beginning, but Mr. Carlson, can you let me know, like, how much both in one-time and ongoing savings by enacting this bill, how much that would put back into the transit system and how that money could be used?
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Tabke. My name is Charles Carlson. I serve as Executive Director for Metropolitan Transportation Services. Within the note, Mr. Chair, we estimate around $24 million of annual savings and $25 million of one-time savings. The $24 million of annual savings is comprised of three primary components. The first is based on analysis of actual costs to deliver an hour of service. We anticipate, because the council contracts with each of these providers already that actually deliver the service, the private companies, that we could deliver this at lower cost, and that comprises about 8.2 or 8.3 million of the savings. 8 million of the savings results from addressing high subsidy bus routes, and I want to be clear that it is only those routes that are in the high subsidy categories that would be reduced. We have guidance that routes operating at 60% above per passenger subsidies should be reduced or eliminated. The bill allows for that, and that is what we included in the note. That is what is the limit of savings, very modest reductions in other routes that are above guidance, but by and large, the bulk of the savings is just those high subsidy routes that we reported on in the past. Finally, there are changes to council services that are made possible from the freeing of contracted capacity. We would contract some of the council's high subsidy bus routes. That would save $7.4 million. And then, as noted in the high subsidy report, some changes in Metro Mobility would allow us to save some money there, and we're estimating $500,000 approximately of ongoing savings in that regard. For one-time savings, the cost of replacement buses for high subsidy bus routes would no longer be necessary. That would save around $25 million in net, we estimate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And so I just will end by saying that I really, really appreciate everybody being here and having this conversation, making sure that we know how important transit is to our communities and how important this is that we get it right. And there are things, Chair Cosner, that I wish we had done a little differently in the lead up to this and making sure that people were brought along as to how this discussion happened and that had happened to make people understand, help people understand better as to how this could go forward and benefit our communities. But I don't know how, seeing that not being done, like I don't know how we move forward without doing this if it's a $25 million one-time savings and then $50 million every budget cycle that we can put back directly into our communities to deliver more transit services and take what everyone loves and make more happen. So I just appreciate everyone's opinions and considerations and discussion about this really important topic. So thank you.
Further discussion. Representative Green.
Thank you, Representative Olson, and thank you, Chair Kosnick, for bringing forward this bill. I think this bill highlights how important our suburban transit needs are. I'm very concerned about this abrupt plan to dismantle something that we've had in our community for 40 years.
Southwest Transit is an outlier. You know, we're very different from MBTA in terms of our customer service ratings, in terms of what we've been able to give to the community. I think our suburban transit companies have been able to adapt more quickly to the needs of the community. We have we've been a lot more innovative in our area. I'm very concerned how this will affect our community. I've received hundreds of emails from my constituents, from people who are college students going to the U of M, college students who are going to Normandale, workers, people with disabilities, seniors who depend on this service to get to medical appointments and to get their groceries. And, you know, people in my community, they love Southwest Transit. The customer service ratings are super high. I don't know what the customer service ratings for Metro Transit is, but in my area, we call it expecting the best. Those green and black buses are very highly regarded. I'm not confident that Metro Transit can adapt as quickly to the needs of my community. I think, you know, in the suburbs and exurbs, we have different needs, and I don't think Metro Transit can be as nimble and adapting to what we need out here. I think good governance involves a lot of citizen participation. I don't think we've had that with this bill. I think this bill warrants a lot more discussion, and I will not be supporting it.
Thank you, Representative Ream. Any further comments? Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Koznick. I do have a bunch of questions. First, I want to say I'm a very big supporter of transit. I think overall we're underinvested in transit. I do have a question, and maybe it's for the individual who runs Southwest Transit. I understand all of the points, but why is it right for the opt-outs in these communities? The argument I've heard is local control, better focus, better responsiveness. Why is it appropriate for those communities, and why isn't it, if that's right, why isn't it that we have this model in every community?
Mr. Chair,
I'm genuinely interested. Like, let's say I take you at this, all right? So then why shouldn't it be in St. Louis Park? Why shouldn't it be in Edina? Why shouldn't every community have their own?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft, Eric Hansen, Southwest Transit. The short answer is they should. There should be more local control. There should be more local input. There should be more local transit agencies. And at the end of the day, I mean, theoretically, you know, 40 years ago when this happened, you know, there was an opportunity for communities to choose, you know, one way or the other. And for whatever reason, I wasn't here 40 years ago. I was in high school at the time. You know, that's what they chose. And then I understand there was another round of that at some point, and Minnetonka and some other communities also chose to opt out a little bit later. But from my standpoint, I think that we should, as a legislature, should actually run another bill to allow people to opt out all the time. Because at the end of the day, it should be about providing service to local people. And so why not St. Louis Park? Why not, you know, your area?
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And hang on a minute.
Okay.
You also made the claim that this isn't going to save money.
Yeah.
But yet what I'm seeing is that the cost of operation for Metro Transit
sure
is significantly lower than those of the opt-outs. And your point was, well, you know, the percentage that has to go is going to be the same, so it doesn't save any money.
Right.
But if they can provide the service more cost effectively, then couldn't we have more transit service?
Mr. Hansen.
Your percentage argument, like, is sort of a, yeah. So why if it can be provided more cost effectively?
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft, I would answer it in a couple of different ways. The first one is that, you know, some of this data gets cherry-picked a little bit. You know, so I could cherry pick another data point for you, and that is that it costs $15 for Metro Transit to send commuter bus people downtown, and it costs us $12.07. So we're 22% more efficient at sending people downtown than Metro Transit. So that's one data point that's a fact, and that's out of the 2024 regional route analysis that was quoted a little bit earlier in the in the meeting. The second thing that I would say is that, you know, you have to look at it from the standpoint of, you know, comparing apples to apples. You know, the reality is that it's going to cost a little bit more in the suburbs to provide transit than it does in the central city. And that really has to do with density, you know, at the end of the day. Because you're going to have, and you, the more density you have, the more riders you have, the more you're going to, the lower subsidy costs that you're going to have. The suburbs don't have that much density. And this leads to my second point, is that if there are any cost savings, which I don't think that there really are, because at the end of the day, we're still collecting the same amount of taxes from people before or after this bill. It's just a question of who spends it. It might be a question of efficiency. And so you have to ask yourself the question, what does that mean? Well, the only thing that it means is that if it's more efficient, what it means is you're going to see service cuts. You know, you're absolutely going to see service cuts in suburban communities. It costs us more to provide microtransit than a lot of other communities. There's no doubt about that. I don't dispute it. Does it mean that it's needed any less? It does not. And so if we're essentially going to say, well, we're going to give this money from the suburbs and we're going to provide it, you know, for Metro Transit, you know, we're going to be doing it on the backs of the people in the suburbs that need the service. You heard from four different riders today talking about what they need. Metro Transit does not provide microtransit service like that. They only provide it around transit hubs, which is why it costs less on a subsidy basis because they're smaller zones. It operates a little bit differently. And so I'm getting a little bit into the weeds on the service delivery here, but you got to compare apples to apples. And you're just not going to get it when you're comparing, you know, services in the central core city to the services in the suburbs.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Appreciate it. Representative Tamke, closing thoughts on this? No closing thoughts. We go to...
I have more questions.
More questions, Representative Kraft.
Thank you. I mean, this is, look, as I said, I'm very interested in transit. This is a, we had a lot of people come in and testify, and I think this is a really important issue. So I actually have a question for Met Council. If they would come up. Thank you, Mr.
Final
Chair.
Final question, Representative Kraft.
Yeah. So do you serve suburbs right now? And how do you deal with high subsidy routes in main areas, you know, suburban areas? Do you serve suburbs right now?
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Real quick, let's get an answer and get moving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft. The Met Council serves the Twin Cities region, including many suburban communities and these communities with Metro Mobility Service, so really a region-wide operation.
Excellent. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, and I appreciate the questions from Representative Kraft. I saw a data point that the Met Council serves like 23 or 25 suburban communities currently. But members, I appreciate the comments from Vice Chair Rehm, and I know that change is difficult and it's hard, and especially you know, for somebody that has this service in their community. And you know, this is a data-driven proposal that wasn't taken, you know, that has been studied and not taken lightly, and it's not intended to be punitive either. However, I know that taxpayers are watching and they expect better from us. I would point out line 3.26 that service coverage continuity that maintains substantially similar transit service routes and service levels for at least a year is included in the bill. After a year, it doesn't mean that service will end. And so I think some riders are being maybe misled a little bit on that, because that is not the intent. We did the highest subsidy report at the beginning of this committee session, and only because of that, we get wind back finally because of some action, and we put the light of day in it, that now they've decided to end those routes. If we don't act, this has been going on for years, that high subsidy routes continue to perpetuate. There is local control, but they have been complicit in this with their boards, and we're not going to go into all that. But, you know, so interestingly, I want to close with, I got an actual old school letter to my house from not a constituent, but somebody in the South Metro. His name's Larry, and he printed this out to me. Maybe you couldn't find my email address, but it's. I want to share it with you in closing. And this is what Minnesotans are watching. We have the data of why this makes sense. Chair Tabke re-highlighted, and no offense, but we did go over the fiscal note in the beginning, but thank you for pointing it out again. But I want to share what a Minnesotan thinks. His name's Larry. He says, "Sir, regarding your actions in the Minneapolis Trib article on little-used transit, you are absolutely on the right track. My wife has Alzheimer's disease, and we do a lot of driving in the Savage, Shakopee, Burnsville areas to pass time. There is a bus rodeo going on all across the South Metro with 59 to 60 passenger metropolitan-type buses, smaller buses, and buses called for specific trips by individuals. These buses seem to have much in common. They are mostly empty along the bus stops. The authorities responsible seem to think that driving and burning up these hundreds of thousands of dollars of vehicles on largely vacant routes is justified when three Dodge minivans would accomplish the same purpose. Unbelievable. Who are these people?" he says. "Keep up the good work. Members, I know change is hard. We've thought about this proposal for many years. I would renew my motion to send this to the Committee on Ways and Means."
Chair Koznick renews his motion to send this bill to the Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed say no.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is sent to the Ways and Means as amended. Next up, members, we have House File 3513. We have an amendment. Mr. Chair, would you like to present your DE2 amendment?
Members, I would we'll take this up, 3518. If Mr. Burris could walk us through.
Mr. Burris.
3513. What we did, members, is take the opinions and comments and ideas from the previous first hearing on automated vehicles, worked with the department and put these ideas together in one, delete all amendments so we can be fresh, and it includes the amendments that we passed. So in the remaining time, if Mr. Burris could walk us through as much as possible on that DE amendment so that the committee is on the same page.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, the DE amendment has the ID of H3513DE2, should be in members' packets. As mentioned, this incorporates a couple of amendments that have been adopted to the underlying bill, but is a delete-all amendment and includes some additional provisions. There are a number of technical changes that includes some degree of restructuring and relocation, addition of subdivisions. One of the technical changes is to establish that the provisions are codified in a new chapter of law, Chapter 169B. So you'll see in the first section, the definition of terms as a new section defining the various terms. There are some modifications to some of the definitions, including some clarification of human driver, which is found on page 2 at 2.18. There's also a concept or a new term established of engaged autonomous operation that is also on page 2 at 2.5. And then section 2 sets out a couple of provisions around the scope and nature of application of the provisions. One piece is found in subdivisions 1 and 2 on application to fully automated vehicles as well as uniform application. This largely reproduces what kind of existed for the underlying bill when it was codified in Chapter 169. So this is similar language. Preemption provisions are also moved into this section. One thing I'll kind of jump back to in talking about the technical changes is there's some terminology changes so that the reference that had been to autonomous vehicles is somewhat narrowed and modified to refer to a fully automated vehicle. So that's the term being used throughout this delete all amendment. And similar to the original definition, the fully automated vehicle refers to a vehicle with a couple of elements to it, but one of those is that it's classified under a SAE international standard as capable of the level 4, level 5 automation. So fully automated kind of is, in the terminology, is reflective of that automation capability. Moving then to the next section in the delete all amendment, section 3 sets out the basic requirements around operations and operations authority. Subdivision 1 lays out some of the core requirements for a vehicle that's a fully automated vehicle to operate without a human driver who would be present in the vehicle. Subdivision 2 sets out some of the requirements of the capability of that vehicle. Among the changes that are in the delete all found in this subdivision, starting on page 5 at 5.1, going to 5.2, there is a limitation established that the fully automated vehicle would have to have a gross vehicle weight that is under 10,000 pounds. Subdivision 3 is a provision on the determination of kind of where the requirements fall in regards to full automation when there isn't a human driver present. That is followed by a couple of provisions that were in the underlying bill and are being relocated from as a kind of technical matter into this section. One other thing that I'll note is a change right in here in the DE2 is found starting at page 5, line 20, which sets out that when a vehicle that's a fully automated vehicle is being operated by a natural individual who's not in the driver's seat, there are some requirements established to that person having a driver's license that is appropriate to the type of vehicle being operated and is located in the United States. This is different language, but somewhat similar to one of the amendments that had been discussed in committee when the bill was up last. Following that, there are a series of subdivisions that are similar to what had been standalone sections regarding the requirements for fully automated vehicles and requirements around collisions. There was a technical amendment or a technical change that pulled out first responder interaction plan requirements out of the definition. That's found on page 6, starting at 6.9. And then moving to page 7, section 4 has a new set of requirements that are introduced in the DE2 amendment. This includes a clarification around the required registration and titling for fully automated vehicles, and also provides authority to the Commissioner of Public Safety regarding registration of the vehicles, and it sets a requirement on the registration of identifying that this type of vehicle is a fully automated vehicle that would be something that the Department of Safety would then have identified. And it sets some authority for refusal or removal of registration for these types of vehicles. Section 5 is also a new addition to the DE2 amendment, and this would set out, it's actually not entirely a new addition. I should maybe rephrase that. It provides additional direction and authority to the Department of Public Safety on issuance of a permit for fully automated vehicle operation. Some of the application requirements were laid out in the original bill. There's some further detail on applications as well as direction to the Department of Transportation on issuance of a permit and makes the permit valid for 2 years. There's also requirements on permit holders or applicants to provide and keep their information up to date. Section 6 sets out vehicle insurance and liability coverage requirements. This includes a technical rewrite, but the substantive language is similar to the original bill. Section 7 sets requirements for the an authorization for an on-demand automated vehicle network. Among the changes are, compared to the original bill, are some additional accessibility requirements that are found in Subdivision 5, which is on page 10, which includes some accessibility in the user interface technology for passengers. And then Section 8, found on page 11 of the DE2 amendment, sets out enforcement powers and capabilities for the Department of Public, the Department of Transportation to suspend, revoke, cancel, rescind suspension of the permit, as well as perform investigations. Section 9 sets out a default penalty of a petty misdemeanor, which matches what was in the original bill. And then finally, Section 10 directs the Department of Transportation to perform a study of impacts related to labor and supply and demand, and sets out some study requirements, identifies stakeholders who should be involved with the developing and performing the study, and requires a legislative report that would be due in February of 2028.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. All those in favor of the DE2 amendment, please signify by saying aye. Any opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Chair Kosnick moves to lay the bill on the table. All those in favor of the motion to lay the bill on the table as amended, please signify by saying aye.
I think you could just lay it, but that's fine. Members, I just wanted the opportunity. Thank you for staying late a little bit later to walk through this DE. It was our attempt to, again, encompass a lot of the concerns that we had and structurally tighten up the bill. We'll bring it back up at another time. Thank you for your time today.
The bill is on the table. Next meeting is Monday, March 16th at 1 p.m. This meeting is adjourned.